This is the Head On Radio Network.
With America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome aboard at a minute past the hour, a minute past six here on the East Coast. A minute past, or heaven only knows what it might be if you're listening via podcast or archived program. Any way you choose to listen, we are thrilled. Everyone here on the horn, absolutely thrilled and overjoyed that you would choose to spend your time with us. Of course, this is not just any old evening. It's the middle of the week. Downhill to Friday, as the saying goes. It is, in fact, Wednesday, and you know what that means.
On this every other Wednesday afternoon discussion club, we are going to have more to discuss on this every other Wednesday afternoon than we ever had on any other every other Wednesday afternoon.
That's right, brethren and sistren. It is prayer meeting Wednesday night. Glad y'all could come up from the fellowship hall where the ladies of the church have provided you a lovely Wednesday night prayer meeting dinner before the services. Come on down to the altar and get your magic cookie. Lay your hands upon the subwoofer and feel the healing rays of faith of blowing through you. Hallelujah! Praise the Lord. Yeah, it's prayer meeting night, and we do have some prayer meeting stories. But somehow or another, it's sort of like a reverse. Well, I don't know. I got up this morning, and the first thing my lovely wife said to me was, Edwards is getting out. So that's how the day started. Not on the best of notes. So that was a tough pill to swallow. Because John Edwards was the best of the three, without a doubt. A man who had made his own journey and gotten somewhere on that journey. Started out making some rather conservatively Southern Democrat mistakes in the Senate and had learned from his mistakes. And who ended his campaign as he began it in the one place in the United States of America that has been more neglected than any other place, New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, having conversations about where America needs to be, where America needs to go, a conversation that no one else is having. So it was a tough and a bitter pill to swallow this morning. John Edwards has, for the time being, decided not to endorse a candidate. I think that's probably wise on his part. It's probably something he should hold close to his vest as time goes on. And if he endorses one or the other, only do so when he's absolutely certain that the endorsement will count for something, that he will get some portion of the issues he has been pounding, get some real respect for those issues. So I understand that decision. Now, here in the hills and hollers, it might be a little bit curious to those of you outside SAME. To hear that level of frustration. But, and this, it is imperative to me that people who care about something, there is environmental walk in the campaign positions of both Senators Clinton and Obama. But when the rubber meets the road, well, they're talking the talk, but not walking the walk. Because somebody's got to get to them and explain to them that clean coal technology is a con, that it's a fraud, that it's a joke, and a sick joke, and a cruel joke on the people who live in this region and who live downstream and downwind from this region. And that means the entire United States east of the Mississippi. Because the way Appalachia is located, everything flows out of here either on the air or in the water. And for so long as mountaintop removal is allowed to persist, to be the poisonous, devastating blight that it is on our landscape, then the Northeast gets its air poisoned, and the Southeast gets its water poisoned, and everybody gets their future poisoned. At this date, both Senators Clinton and Obama embrace the fraud of clean coal technology. At this point in time, both Senators Obama and Clinton embrace the idea that you can use 8 gallons of water to create 1 gallon of liquid coal fuel. And that then one must deal with the wastewater, which can never be salvaged again, in order to fuel, among other things, the United States Air Force. They embrace it. I don't know if they've never had to fly over the moonscapes that West Virginia and Appalachia in general have been turned into as a result of this clean coal technology and this liquid fuel technology, liquid coal technology, or if somebody's just given them a big wad of cash from the coal association. I honestly don't know what the explanation is, but I do know this: both of those people are intelligent enough that if they are shown the vile racket that clean coal and liquid coal and mountaintop removal are, that they can be brought around to a sane position. As I've noted before, it's worth remembering that the mountaintop removal only really got a good running start once George Bush got into office and began to vitiate the Clean Water Act. It was not the issue during the first Clinton presidency that it is today. It just wasn't. It had happened, it was going on, but with much, much stricter controls. And I think with an understanding that it was an absolutely poisonous practice. And the same thing applies to most progressive issues. You want to end the war sooner than later? You've got a chance of accomplishing that with either Senator Clinton or Senator Obama. You've got a chance. And that's all any of us can ask, is a chance, a fighting chance. You know, we're the lower class and we're the middle class, and we never asked for anything to be given to us. From the moment we were born to the moment that we die, we carry this nation on our back, and we do so gladly, and we do so willingly, and we never ask for anything. Because that's our job as the middle class. That's what we do. All we want is a chance. one fighting chance. Hell, we buy lottery tickets. Some of us go to the dog track or the bingo parlor or the slot machine houses because all we want is a chance. And with either of those two senators, Obama or Clinton, you have that chance. Labor has a chance to finally level the playing field via the Employee Free Choice Agreement that was filibustered and stopped dead in its tracks last year by those same sons of bitches in the Senate who say all we want is an up or down vote for this wild-eyed, freakish judicial nominee. Environmentalists have a chance because we will have a seat at the table. For the last 8 years, we've stood shivering in the cold while Dick Cheney put his energy task force together, and well before the planes ever flew into the buildings on September 11th, was looking at maps of Iraq with oil pipelines outlined on them. You know that. That's fact. It's not. I'm not just sitting here telling you stuff. We have a chance. The people who believe that two people ought to be able to get married based upon their love for each other and their desire to spend the rest of their lives together, regardless of their gender, those people, with Obama and Clinton, at least have a chance. With McCain, with Romney, you don't have a chance. You don't have a seat at the table. You are not part of the equation, let alone the solution. It seems pretty stark and pretty clear, the choice to me. So I will opt for that chance in November. I will opt for a chance versus no chance. I will vote. Well, look, I'll tell you right now. The way Democratic Party politics, and more particularly than that, the way the media have run these campaigns, my chances have been getting narrowed since the moment we first started talking about the election. I started out with Dennis Kucinich. The media worked really hard, really early to take that away. So I moved to John Edwards. The media worked very hard and diligently and around the clock to make sure that that choice did not inure to me. So Edwards is gone. And recognizing, of course, that my vote in May of 2008 is a ceremonial vote at best, I will tell you at this point that my vote is for Barack Obama as well. I don't think that's ever been a I don't think there's ever been any question about that. So we do not get to vote for the perfect, but we do have a chance at electing the good. Is there anybody out there within the sound of my voice that thinks John McCain is going to listen to the aching voices of the people who are besieged by coal companies in Appalachia? Is there anyone out there who believes for even a split second that John McCain or Willard Romney will ever listen to the plight of two people who have loved each other for 30, 40, 50 years and cannot get married and have the same rights as every other married couple in America? Have the rights that are guaranteed to them under the Constitution of the United States? Does anybody think that Romney or McCain would give those people a millisecond's time? Hell no, they wouldn't. Labor? You think you're gonna get a cold cup of coffee with Romney or McCain? Hell no. Seems to me the choice is pretty clear. McCain himself has said that he doesn't mind if our troops are in the Middle East for 100 years, a couple of generations. You think he's going to care if you march around the White House or carry a sign on a Saturday and then go home on Sunday? Hell no! But with Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, you have a chance. Because the nature of the campaigns that they are running dictate that they must listen when they are spoken to, especially if the voice is loud enough. Now, I can't be clear enough. The war has to end. John Edwards was as close as any of those three got to my position on the war. End it. Start flying the troops home. Having played a few games of Risk and some Avalon Hill battle, historical board games in the past, I understand that you can't just pick up and leave, and that the guys who are left there while the other people are coming home have to be safe. I understand that. But until you commit to start bringing the troops home, you can't even start thinking about the logistics of how. No one is going to consider those logistics if the person in the White House is another pasty-faced, doughy, white guy like Willard Romney or John McCain. If you want a seat at the table, if you want even a chance, just the fighting chance that every working man and woman in America yearns for, I'm sorry. You simply must, and I don't mean because I'm telling you, I mean from a moral imperative standpoint, must support the Democratic nominee in November. Because if you don't, it's only become more likely that the issues you want addressed will not be. 17 minutes past the hour, and just to let you know, we will have a brand new Strictly Confidential coming your way tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And we will have coming up here shortly a conversation with one of the best friends the show has, author and traveler and all-around just darn nice person, Jeff Biggers, author of The United States of Appalachia and In the Sierra Madre. He has a wonderful, wonderful essay about Black History Month, which is approaching, begins on February 1st, over at Huffington Post today. He'll be joining us at the bottom of this hour. And a little treat for you coming up later in the week. You know, John Fox lives in the future. When it's Friday here, it's Saturday there in John Fox world. So he doesn't usually do his show on Friday nights, but we're moving toward changing that just a little bit. Live from deep in the heart of Texas, Friday night, horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner will come your way for a live hour taking calls, discussing and cussing and discussing. And I think if you've enjoyed Rick's place, and I know you have, I think you're going to enjoy Rick Goodner live even more. So please, it'll be Rick's first time going live. Make that first time a special thing for him, and let's give him a great big humongous live audience at roughly midnight Eastern Time this coming Friday. Can you do that? Pretty please? So those are our show. And oh, one more. A little reminder, I will not be here Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday of next week. For the first time since before 9/11, I will set foot on an aircraft Monday morning in Charleston, West Virginia, and I just hope it doesn't fly me directly to Guantanamo Bay. I'm going to board the plane wearing nothing but flip-flops and a Speedo, so that there won't be any question of me being any sort of subversive. Nothing, you know, nothing. What? You know, nothing to search. Hopefully, you know, make them not want to go and do the full cavity search before the flight.
Can I come watch, Bob?
Oh, baby, you're picking out the Speedo. So, no shows Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. I don't know if we get back soon enough on Wednesday, maybe, but I don't think there's a very great chance of that. I'm going to be going. You know, this whole thing is going on all over the country. It's a national phenomenon about environmental issues. And as a consequence, I'll be participating in what's going on. It's called Focus the Nation. And as part of that, Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts, is sponsoring a discussion and a forum. And I'm going to Williamstown, Massachusetts, to Williams College, a fine, fine, fine liberal arts institution. I'm a big liberal arts kind of guy. I'm going up there, and another member of Coal River Mountain Watch is going up there, and we're going to try to sort of show the flag for Appalachia in that discussion. So that's going to take up my Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of next week. Okie dokie? Okie dokie. So that's all the programming announcements that I have for the time being. Let's see if there's anybody on the phone there. Hi, who have I got?
Here's me.
Hey, Susan, what's up?
Well, I got myself a really, really interesting conversation going over on the Obama blogs about mountaintop removal and clean coal. Yep. Anyway, I would appreciate it if you could shoot me links to any facts that I can use, because I want to drive this point home with a sledgehammer.
You mean his support for clean coal technology?
Well, I want to show him where he's wrong.
Wait. So you got to help me a little bit here, Susan. Are you up against people who are saying that clean coal technology is the bee's knees and the way to go?
No, No. They're saying I need more information.
Okie dokie.
Really nice. You know, they're not.
They are nice, and this isn't about me disliking Barack Obama. This is about me wanting to change Barack Obama.
That's exactly it. That's what I'm doing. Is I need stuff to educate him. I've already put in the link to Coal River, to Coal River Mountain Watch, to I Love Mountains. I even mentioned the fact that they're due to start blasting 800 feet from Nanette's house any time. I didn't use her full name.
Yeah. Well, good. I mean, it would be nice if that matters to Obama's supporters. It would be nice to see if they can light up the Obama campaign.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing it for. Is I figure if I make enough of a stir with enough information, factual information, somebody on the staff is liable to say, hey, we got something going here, and there's a lot of information here. Maybe we ought to check it.
You'd like to hope that that's the way the system works.
Yeah. But at any rate, that's, you know, if nothing else, I can convert a few of these people.
So, just because there are people listening who will send me links, because, you know, I can't very well do much research on the fly, you know, kind of occupied right
now. Well, I understand that. I figure
what information are you looking for?
Like how much water it takes to create a gallon of
liquid coal?
Coal.
5 to 8 gallons, but I guess you want a website proving it, right?
Yeah, I can't just say, okay, it takes this amount, because they'll say, okay, well, no, prove it. And I can't blame them.
Okay. Gang, you've heard the, this is the call for information. Anybody that wants to try to help with this is more than welcome to do so. Send it to me via email, please, bob@headonradio.com, and I will forward these on to Susan.
Yeah, because
I'm pretty sure that Nanette can find some things that will be persuasive. So
yeah, I tried to call her earlier, but she wasn't home. So
right.
But I figured as soon as the announcement about John Edwards came, and I was just in tears. Dang. I immediately got on to the Obama blog because, given a choice, that would be the one to go. Although, don't let me hear anybody say they will not vote for Hillary if she's the nominee. People, you vote for the Democratic nominee. I don't care if it's Beelzebub.
I'm kind of I want to make it clear that it's not because, ooh, you know, granddaddy was a Democrat and daddy was a Democrat and I'm a Democrat. That's not why. It's because
Supreme Court.
There is the Supreme Court, and there is no, and again, there is no commonality. What progressive has a commonality of interest with John McCain or Willard Romney?
Both. Or worse yet, Huckabee.
Yeah, I'm hoping he's about done, but you know it's going to take. It'll take Super Tuesday to put him away.
Well, what you know what scares me? He's the great good friend of John McCain. He could end up as John McCain's running mate, and John McCain is getting up there. And my nightmare is John McCain in the White House and keeling over from the coronary. And guess who ends up as president?
This is the big one, Elizabeth. Yeah, and, you know, President Huckabee. Well, again, and I think I mentioned this maybe a week or so ago, that was the beginning of Huckabee's entire career. He was lieutenant governor of Arkansas when Jim Guy Tucker got shuffled off to prison. And bang, he's governor of Arkansas. And the next thing you know, he's the anointed of the Almighty.
Yeah. I do not want...
And the thing is, I'd hate he thinks the hand of God is moving him toward the presidency. I wouldn't be surprised to see him put a little digitalis in John McCain's coffee if he was vice president.
Yeah, I would if I were John McCain and I got into office with him as vice president.
Or Karari, or you know anything.
Employ a food case.
Almond cookie, Mr. President.
Yeah.
You know what I mean, Susan. Thank you so much. And as the information comes in, I'll forward it on to you. All right.
Okay, thank you back.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye.
There's the homework assignment. We need information to forward to the Obama campaign about the depredations and the fraud of clean coal, and we need information to forward to the Obama campaign about exactly what it takes to make the liquid coal miracle. So just send it to bob@headonradio.com. As I said earlier in the program, one of the best friends of the program and one of my favorite writers to whom I have been introduced via the program is Jeff Biggers, author of The United States of Appalachia and In the Sierra Madre, and most recently the author of an excellent essay over at Huffington Post regarding the origins and the future of Black History Month and Black History. Well, Jeff has kindly consented to join us for a conversation this evening. He's out in Illinois just now, and he's with us now. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the program. I'm so glad you could be with us this evening.
It's great to be back, Bob. It's always a pleasure to be on your program.
I enjoy. You know, I think if you wrote the ingredients list on the side of a toothpaste tube, I'd enjoy it. So
it's great.
It's a real blast. I saw the Huffington Post article today, and it jumped up and grabbed me because Black History Month is soon upon us, and a lot of times it's sort of, I don't know, it feels like something that's sort of gone about with a rather perfunctory fashion. You know, this is Fox News, and that's your Black History Minute. Now back to our racist news coverage.
Right.
But you've done it. You've done a brilliant thing of talking about the history of the celebration or the recognition of Black History Month, as well as taking it into the future. Give us a little bit of background. Where did Black History Month come from?
Well, Bob, I think to begin with, it's this incredible gift of many gifts that comes out of West Virginia. But most importantly, it comes out of the coal fields of West Virginia. And what I really wanted to write about today was West Virginia and Appalachia have this amazing legacy that is either going to be buried by the coal fields or it's going to be reclaimed by people today, both for history but also for the future. And so I looked at Black History Month on top of something else, which is mountaintop removal, because two very important firsts took place in Fayette County. And that's, of course, where a man by the name of Carter Woodson, a young man in the 1890s, a black man whose family went to Appalachia because there were schools for African Americans at that point, had to follow his brothers into the coal fields. He worked for several years. He called it his six-year apprenticeship in the coal mines. And while he was there, he would hang out at this inn. He called it a tea room of other black coal miners. He began to hear these extraordinary stories of life in West Virginia, of life during the Civil War and the Reconstruction era. And it really put the love of history into him. It's really where it became deepened and intensified, as he wrote later. And of course, Booker T. Washington went on to get a degree at Berea College. He went off to Harvard University and got his PhD in history, and he wrote his dissertation on Virginia and Appalachia. He went on to become a great historian, but most people don't realize that in 1920, he lost his job at Howard University. And only one college in the whole country would give him a job, and that was a West Virginia Collegiate Institute. And there he became the dean of this college. It was a black school, and it was very important because there he began to really invest his time and energies for his journal of what he called Negro History, which eventually became part of Negro History Week. And it was there in West Virginia that he got this extraordinary grant from the Carnegie Foundation that allowed him to go on and really become one of the most celebrated historians in the United States and really considered the father of black history.
It creates a little bit of pride in my beating heart, Jeff, because this program originates from Fayette County, West Virginia.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And we have a gentleman around here who does reenactments of Carter Woodson. And it's a magnificent thing to behold. He's a poet, and he's worked really, really hard to bring Carter Woodson to life. His is an amazing story from Berea. You know, Harvard was no... There was nothing simple about his getting into Harvard, as I understand it.
Oh, no, it was an extraordinary experience, in fact, that he actually got through and was actually able to complete his degree as well. And we have to recall, of course, too, that another amazing black American who came from West Virginia by the name of Martin Delaney also tried to go to Harvard University at their medical school, and he was rejected, even though he was probably one of the most prominent doctors at that point in Pittsburgh, Martin Delaney, who had the only African-American newspaper at one point in the 1840s. So really 50 years later, you had someone like Carter Woodson who still was really pushing the barriers and bringing that sense of the vanguard, this incredible role of West Virginia, to the nation's most important university there at Harvard University.
And now you mentioned that Carter Woodson arose out of a six-year apprenticeship in the coal mines. At that point in time, I don't know that the UMW had largely not been recognized in the West Virginia coal fields, but it was a birthing in other parts of the country. But at no point in time did the United Mine Workers ever say no to an African American man who wanted to become part of the union. All this rises out of Appalachia, as you've done such a magnificent job pointing out in your book. What impact, because you do such a good job linking the two together, what impact does mountaintop removal have on the legacy that something like Black History Month and Carter Woodson presents?
Right. You would think there'd be absolutely no connection whatsoever. You would think, you know, that I'm a person who defends coal miners, of course, coming from a coal mining family, and my grandfather, of course, being a coal miner and someone who died with black lung. But I see coal miners, of course, and especially the African-American experience of the coal fields as being a vibrant part of our history that we have to protect and we have to reclaim. What you have with mountaintop removal, of course, is just the reverse. It's something that completely displaces minors. It divides communities and ultimately destroys our communities that have this tremendous legacy we have to defend. There in Fayette County in 1970, a century later, after Carter Woodson, of course, went underground, a century later, 1970, the first mountaintop remove operation was launched. And there in a little holler called Bullpush Mountain. And it began quietly, really without anybody knowing what was going on. It took another 25 years at least before we really recognized what was going on with this mountaintop removal. This incredible process of blowing up mountains and dumping the waste into the waterways and the valleys just to get at the coal. And in the meantime, not only are they destroying the mountains, over 450 mountains that have been destroyed, they're destroying the communities and waterways, and they're strip mining this incredible cultural landscape that Appalachia had been building.
Including folks like Booker T. Washington, right?
Booker T. Washington and Martin Delaney. It's funny, you know, I probably told you this before, but I'll tell you again. I was supposed to speak in Chicago last year, and I was supposed to be there, ironically, in February, and they called back and said, come in April. And because February is Black History Month, and that book you wrote about those people down there just doesn't fit into Black History Month. And this was a really well-meaning school in Chicago. And I said, what do you mean? Black History Month founder comes out of Appalachia. Booker T. Washington, of course, and the coal mine communities as well. Martin Delaney, you know, some of our greatest writers like William Denby and Henry Louis Gates and Nikki Giovanni and so many amazing people coming out of Appalachia. So many of our great musicians like Nina Simone, of course, and Bessie Smith, the Empress of the Blues and the Father of the Blues, W.C. Handy, coming out of Appalachia. Nobody knows that, you know, John Henry, when we sing that ballad as kids, is pounding those rails through Appalachia, you know. And this was this incredible legacy of African Americans that we've lost. And I think that's your real task, Bob, and that's why I love coming on your show, and I feel like your show is incredibly important, is because you're forcing your audience and forcing your listeners to really grapple with this situation. What is going to be your legacy? What are you going to be telling your children about 20 years from now, the first mountaintop removal operation in Fayette County, or are you going to be telling them about the incredible legacy of Carter Woodson and how he changed the way we lived in America?
And as much as mountaintop removal, Jeff, is a war on the environment in West Virginia and on the culture in West Virginia, it's also a war on our legacy. It's a war on our future and the war that we portray ourselves and how we view ourselves. You've expressed it so very well. I think about the fact that they're doing an MTR job on Blair Mountain, for heaven's sakes, and don't
right.
think that wasn't intentional.
Right, exactly.
Because if you can blow up Blair Mountain, you can make sure that there's no Blair Mountain for West Virginia school children to visit and remember that there was a time when working people, black and white alike, stood up against the coal companies that even then were trying to keep them in a form of slavery.
Exactly. And I think that's why what I do supposedly as a cultural historian, I never see myself as an environmentalist. I feel like that's a misnomer. You know, I'm someone who believes in humanity. But I think what we have to recognize is that the neglect and the abuse of humanity, the abuse of our culture, always goes hand in hand with the abuse of the land. And of course, I know that firsthand, you know, having my own 200 years of backwood heritage in Southern Illinois in our coal fields, and seeing my grandfather run through the mill. You know, someone who struggled all of his life just to pay his rent. Someone, you know, who died from black lung, who was buried with pieces of coal buried in his face, which he barely survived from a cave-in. And then 50 years later, seeing my homestead that we'd had for 200 years get strip-mined, because there was a sense of, you don't matter, you're just white trash people out there. Your culture is disposable, and therefore your land is disposable. And I think that's why Carter Woodson's so important, very much in this issue, for environmentalists, but for all people. Because he told black audiences and white audiences alike, he said, you have a wonderful history, but if you're unable to demonstrate it to the world, they will say to you, you are not worthy to enjoy the blessings of democracy or anything else. And they'll say to you, who are you? And they'll despise you, and they'll take your land. And I feel like that's the bitter lesson of history that Appalachia knows too well, and that Appalachia has to fight today.
And when there's no Appalachia left, there's no Appalachian history left, is there?
No, I mean, I think that's the truest statement. You destroy the mountains, you're going to take the mountaineers with it. And, And that's something I think that unites all people, whether you're an environmentalist, whether you're a person who just grew up in these mountains and have found yourself in a coalfield community, is that we're all there to protect who you are and protect your history, but more importantly, this incredible legacy. Because once it's gone, it's gone. And you should go see where my family is from now. It's just these quaint little rolling hills of green grass and nothing else grows. And we have the most incredible diversity outside of Appalachia. It's really called the Illinois Ozarks.
I know exactly the region you're talking about.
It's the same thing up there in Fayette County. If you go to Bullpush Mountain in Fayette County, it's amazing. It's just this little green, looks like a golf course, where there used to be at least 80 types of trees, an incredible species. There used to be an incredible culture, an incredible history of people living there as well. And now it's just grass that you'll find anywhere else in the country, even out here in flat western Illinois where I live today.
And as a matter of fact, when I go to Charleston, and I'll be going to Charleston to get on an airplane Monday, I'll drive right past that whole affair, Cannelton Hollow,
right.
And the Cannelton mines that were even that modern story is a story of the destruction of a culture and a people, because the original coal company that was running it went bankrupt, wrote off the pensions that they had to pay to their retired miners as liabilities on their bankruptcy. Massey Energy purchased it, threw all the working miners out, all the union miners out, and opened up a scab operation.
Mm.
Right there, you've got 50, 75 years of history of deep mining, even, and mm-hmm. just rubbed out, erased. I love this quote you've got in the essay from Milan Kundera. Oh, goodness. The struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. What a beautiful thing that is, and how true it is here in the Appalachians, Jeff, because I looked at my daughter. I've got a daughter. She's an eighth grader, and in eighth grade, they do West Virginia history. And so I looked at her West Virginia history book, and it would appear that at least as textbook writers are concerned, we have lost the battle of memory against forgetting,
mm-hmm.
because and once upon a time workers were not treated very well, but everybody's treated well in West Virginia now.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't take it, Jeff, and I had to sit her down and said, you know, honey, it's not that way. Fortunately for me, I had a copy of the United States of Appalachia at hand, and I said, you want to augment your West Virginia history? Get busy with this. And she was absolutely captivated, Jeff, I've got to tell you.
That's great.
Your
that's
book
great.
Can...
That's wonderful to hear, Bob. And not to interrupt you, I was at a college not too long ago there in West Virginia, and I was telling your wife, I was speaking to this course on West Virginia politics, and so it was an upper-level course, and not one student in the room could place Blair Mountain on a map. They didn't really even know the history. And, of course, it's not their fault, but they literally had no context or background to ever have discussed the Cold Wars in their textbooks in high school and college. And I think that's the kind of thing that we are starting to deal with is this forgetting. You know, Kundera went on to write that forgetting is a form of death, even that's present within life. And I think that kind of death of our history and our legacy is incredibly destructive today.
So you get around quite a bit. I've been asking the questions of people who are involved in talking about mountaintop removal and Appalachian culture, who are outside of Appalachia. Do you see a growing awareness out there, Jeff? Are people becoming more aware of what makes their lights come on when they turn them on and leave them on, or where the energy comes from? Is there a rising awareness of mountaintop removal?
I think there is. There definitely is. I mean, there are 10 documentary films either out or in the process of coming out. Of course, you have Sinerson's book, Coal River, and you had Lost Mountain, which came out a couple of years ago. I think nationwide people see it, but still it has this incredible sense of distance for them. It's back there in Appalachia. I think, to me, one of the most important media events was when Google worked together with a group called Appalachian Voices to create a website called ilovemountains.org. And there you're able to enter your zip code and find out whether the coal that is used at the coal fire plant for your electricity, wherever you live in the United States, comes from a mountaintop removal operation. And so here I am in western Illinois. I live right off the Mississippi River near Iowa. And how far away can I be from a mountaintop removal operation, you would think? And so I put in my zip code, and lo and behold, my energy company, it's called Ameren CIPS, which is in St. Louis, buys an incredible, considerable amount of their coal for their coal-fired plants, not from Illinois, but from mountaintop removal operations in Appalachia. So even here, I'm culpable. I'm definitely part of this mountaintop removal. And so I feel like that kind of media event, which really forces the rest of the nation to come up to the mountain and look out and see what's really happening. Every time you turn on your light switch, it's going to be very significant to realize it's just not something happening down there with those people in Appalachia, but it's something that affects the whole nation. So, yes, I'm very optimistic. But, Bob, I tell you, Bob, I feel like 2008 is the year of reckoning for coal. And I see that in many senses. I think both with the elections, both with a lot of incredible citizens' movements, you're going to have a reckoning with coal both there in West Virginia but across the country.
I sincerely hope you're right. I can feel it. I can feel the groundswell of the worm turning, if you know what I mean. And I think that we are building awareness. I know from the responses that I get on this program and on this network, because we are very proud to be partially sponsored by Coal River Mountain Watch on all of our programs. I'm hearing from people saying, "Oh my God, I had no idea."
Right.
And that's the beginning place. When people say, when people see that with shock and horror what it is that that they're relying on in order to have their energy needs met, it begins, you know, like I said, shock is the beginning, but then there is a movement toward trying to address the problem, at least among the kind of folks who listen to this network, and I think that's where solutions come from. It's pressure put on politicians by people at the grassroots level, because, well, most politicians don't start out from the right position because they hear from the wrong people. It's terribly easy to have a guy in a suit come up with a check for your PAC from the National Coal Association. Oh, sure. Well, you know, clean coal. It's clean coal.
Right.
Well,
right.
As long as it's clean.
Right. And I think you hit it just before I came on your show. I heard you talking about Barack Obama. And, you know, my last piece on Huffington Post was called The Cold Truth on the Candidates. And there it took a tremendous amount of heat because I basically felt like we need to call the Democrats on the carpet on this issue. You know, Barack Obama has been a tremendous supporter of the coal industry in southern Illinois in a very ruthless way. And Hillary Clinton, of course, is a big favorite among America Power, which is the big pack now behind the coal companies that sort of haunt all these different campaign events. You know, all the Democratic presidential debates have been sponsored by a front group for King Coal, which is called America's Power. They have these vans that go around to every event so you can see how it works. And there's this incredible Orwellian thing going on that you talk about how they want to convince everybody using children in these television ads.
Oh, I know.
That somehow coal is clean. And I think, you know, we need to educate people like Barack Obama and, of course, educate the Clintons to recognize that it's just not global warming 50 years or 100 years down the road that we have to talk about. We have to talk about how you extract coal and how coal is not clean for places like West Virginia.
Oh, you're so right. And the use of the children is particularly disgusting because there's one where the image is of a little girl laying on her bed reading a book, and the spring breeze is blowing through her pretty white curtains, and it's all green and lovely outside. And I've never been able to watch that, Jeff, without thinking, you know, if her bedroom was in Sylvester, West Virginia, those white curtains would be black.
All right. That's a great point. Yeah, exactly.
I'm really glad to know that you're out there doing what you're doing, and that you're doing it in places where people don't necessarily think about these things. Are you traveling much right now, Jeff?
Yeah, definitely. I've definitely been in nearly 30 states in the past couple of years, and continue to sort of keep up that that pace. We'll be back in Arizona and California this month, and then in your neck of the woods in Appalachia through March and April, sort of hopscotching as usual, sort of speaking at different colleges and events. I tell you, Bob, this is what I would ask of your listeners, and this is why I'm so happy to go on your program, because it does have a national reach. I tell you, you should really know this. After I'm on your program, I always get two or three emails from people around the country, so it's really nice to know that your program has an extended reach. But I always tell people, I'll get an email from someone in West Virginia who has my book, and I'll say, and they'll be very very nice about it and complimentary. And my sense is, it's not only do folks in West Virginia need to read my book or many other books about Appalachia, but we need to send these books out. You know, we all have cousins and in-laws and whatnot. We all know somebody who's living out there in San Francisco or living in Detroit, who's part of the out-migration that went to Dayton or Akron. We know people in New York City. You know, we know Moreland Spurlock from Beckley, who lives in New York City. And those people need to know this legacy that is down here, and this legacy they've left behind, and this legacy that desperately needs to be embraced by the rest of the country. And I think it's the same thing with Black History Month coming out of West Virginia and so many other issues, is that we need to get that message out. And we need to constantly just keep knocking on doors. And I think probably if Appalachia could do anything right now, especially the anti-mountaintop removal movement, is they need to go as far away from Appalachia as they can to start knocking on people's doors to really recognize what you all have back there. And so if you have listeners who do live in Portland or who do live in Arizona, who are down in Florida, I really hope they do start to pass the word about the situation there.
Well, I think it is happening more and more. And this essay in particular, Jeff, should be, you know, you mentioned, I mentioned the Obama campaign. This essay, especially given Barack Obama's unique position as potentially the first president of African heritage, this needs to be set on his desk in front of him for his reading and his comprehension, because there you have identified a nexus here between the idea of this Black History Month was a struggle in its own right, acknowledging that Americans of African descent had even contributed to the history of this nation was a monumental struggle.
Right.
And what you're identifying here is the fact that all of that work could be marginalized and negated by erasing the place where the whole idea began.
Right.
And I don't know how reading something like that couldn't get all the way into the soul of a man like Barack Obama.
Right.
So,
right.
You know,
you would hope so, right.
I have a feeling this will be linked on some of the Obama boards before this, if it hasn't already been, before this conversation is out. Jeff Biggers, thank you so much. One of these days, you're going to be somewhere, and I'm going to get to come along and at least say howdy, so we can know each other when we pass on the street. It is always a joy, though, and any time you've got anything that is setting your soul afire, I hope you will certainly share it here.
You bet, and keep it up, Bob. Your program is really important, and really appreciate having me today.
Take care, Jeff.
Okay, take care.
Bye now. Jeff Biggers, author of The United States of Appalachia, author of In the Sierra Madre. Jeff has an affinity for mountain people. And he does a magnificent job in both books, because both books focus on mountain people. And if you read both books, you'll find, you know, you can draw little threads of comparison between the two. Whether it be the Rarámuri of the Sierra Madre Occidental of Mexico, or the mountain people of Appalachia. There are commonalities to them, and they're beautiful commonalities, and they transcend race, they transcend ethnicity, they transcend religion and economics. What did he say? 80 species of trees grew on the site where the first mountaintop removal job was undertaken, and now it grows nothing but scrub grass. And here's the fun part, friends and neighbors, brothers and sisters, kiddies and cousins. It's going to grow that nothing but that scrub grass for the next 10,000 years or more. at some date in the future, when it is possible that people living on this continent will not even know the name of the United States of America or Virginia or West Virginia, there will be barren, dead places where they do not go because perhaps they deem it haunted or a doomed place or a place where to go there means that you bring death back with you. And they will wonder why. And they will wonder about the people who made those dead places. They will wonder, perhaps, depending on how civilization holds up or doesn't, whether perhaps those places were made by devils, demons set loose upon the earth. For no human being with any regard for life or the health of their family or their tribe, their clan, their group, their state, no human being would ever do that to the place that they live, would they? Kill everything that supports life? Over thousands upon thousands upon thousands of acres, that could only be the work of some supernatural force. That could only be the work of some devil. That could only be the work of the malevolent hand of demonic forces scraping and leeching the very existence and life-supporting magic from the soil itself. That couldn't be the work of the people who lived there. Of course not. Kind of changes everything when you think about it that way. What happens in 10,000 years when somebody walks up on a sludge lake, a sea of viscous, poisonous, death-dealing goo? What happens when the mud dam gives away and wipes out every living thing around it? Because, you know, for all the coal industry says, well, these are dams. They're dirt dams. They are mud walls. And they're already leaking and cracking. I had, I've told you a little bit about the mountaintop removal jobs that have been begun near where I am now, down in Anstead and over east into the western part of Greenbrier County, whence we hear the blasting now on a daily basis. Saw a blog post the other day called The Battle for Gauley Mountain, Battle for Gauley, G-A-U-L-E-Y, Gauley Mountain. That's where they're blasting away back behind Anstead. Apparently the old-timers around here know a little something that the coal monsters don't know. And that is, in that area where they are at present blasting and carrying out every last scrap of coal they can get at, there are at least three underground mines that are absolutely brimful of water. If any one of those mines blows out on the Anstead side, Anstead is gone. Washed away. Inundated. Deluged. And one of the first things that the water will hit is our little Head Start Center down in the holler across from the ball field. The old-timers know that. I suspect The coal monsters know it too. The only difference between the old-timers and the coal monsters is that the coal monsters just don't care. You're listening to America's liberal voice. You're listening to the horn. And we'll be back. I'm Bob Kincaid.
I pray thee, Lord, my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake,
across Appalachia. Children pray at night. Coal companies are destroying Appalachia with 3 million pounds of high explosives per day. Take a stand. Go to CRMW.net. Coal River Mountain Watch. Be part of the solution so you and they can sleep at night. Coal River Mountain Watch. CRMW.net.
The trains are rolling by and I can feel the ground rumbling.
Don't touch that mouse. Strictly Confidential is LGBT radio. 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Many colors in the homo rainbow. Don't be afraid to let your color shine. Many colors in the homo rainbow. Show me yours, I'm gonna show you mine.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're Head On with Bob Kincaid.
I suppose now we widen the scope of our inquiry just a bit. Welcome to the second hour of tonight's prayer meeting edition of Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid. Looking outward. Hey, before we go to the next story, I want to ask you a question, if I may, please. And I sincerely, this is not a rhetorical question. I'm not much in the rhetorical question business when you get right down to it. If I ask a question, you can bet it's because I don't know the answer, and I would like to have your input. So you know the email address, bob@headonradio.com. And I'd like to have your thoughts on something, because it's something we're thinking about. And, you know, if you're going to dream, best dream big, you know. We talk a lot about trying to get messages to the candidates, trying to get messages to other people, trying to raise awareness of what it really means to be a liberal, what it really means to have progressive ideas. And also, from the shameless public relations standpoint, how on earth we can ever expand awareness of and knowledge of what we're doing, what you're doing here at the Horn. Now, the Democratic National Convention is going to take place from the 24th to the 28th of August in Denver, Colorado. One would think that the vast majority of Democrats there will be interested in Democratic issues. Of course, CBS will be there. Not going to hear any liberal or Democratic issues or progressive issues from CBS. NBC will be there. Nope, sorry. No liberal issues from NBC. Fox will be there. ABC will be there. The Mouse will be there. The Toxic Rat will be there. Disney News will be there. Think they're going to let anything progressive or liberal hit their airwaves? Oh, baby, no. No, no, no. CNN will be there. You know, chicken noodle news. You think they're going to have the progressive moment covering the convention? Nope. No liberalism on CNN. Maybe they'll send Glenn Beck. Yeah, because he's a good liberal. Not. Who else? What else? You know, maybe there will be a few blogging contingents there. I'm sure some of the individual talk radio hosts will be there. But my question to you is, when the Democratic National Convention comes around, how in the world are you going to get a progressive liberal viewpoint on the campaign for the presidency when there aren't any liberals or progressives there? At least none worth speaking of much. Now, a second question. Would it be worth your time to tune in if the horn was there? Would it be worth your time to blog your little fingers off to let other liberals, other progressives, other Democrats know that the horn was there, that there was a real, live, honest-to-God liberal medium there? Would it? How would you like to be able to fire up your computer and every day of the convention have convention coverage all day long and into the night? If you're gay or gay friendly, how would you like to be able to hear that perspective from the Democratic National Convention? If the environment matters to you, how would you like to hear somebody asking questions of people at the Democratic National Convention who really, really was a teeth-bared environmentalist? How would you like to hear somebody who reveres the liberal policies of FDR talk about bringing them into the 21st century with policymakers? How would you like all that? How would you like to have live blogging? Photographs, maybe even video, coming from the convention in Denver, instead of having to watch the prepackaged, vacuum-sealed, all the life sucked out of it, professional, corporatized, commercial media version of it? How would you like to have it straight, no chaser instead? Well, I'm telling you that you can. I'm not going to speak for anybody else because I don't have firm commitments, but there are conversations going on about the entire horn, or as much of the horn as we can get there, going to Denver to cover all day, every day, the Democratic National Convention in August 2008. We have an offer from someone who I will at this point in time leave nameless. To cover hotels and so forth for us once we get to Denver. That leaves up to us the matter of getting to Denver. I have no idea what the cost is right now. I know that, first of all, I know that I couldn't fly, not because I'm afraid to or no. But because if you put all the equipment that it's going to take on a plane, the plane's going to wind up, you know, in Johannesburg. Or if not the plane, our equipment certainly will. And when we do get it back 10 days after the convention, it's going to come back to us in pieces. So we got to drive. And that's about a 3-day drive from here. We can make it, we can make it a 3-day drive. And have everybody else fly in. And really, really, with our teeth showing, show the world what liberal media are all about. Show the world what the future of broadcasting is. I haven't calculated all the costs yet, as I said. having the costs covered in Denver is a humongous. It's the only way we could even begin to talk about it. And frankly, it's a. I don't know. Maybe I'm being silly even talking about it right now, because we got one day left in January, and we are what, $1,800 away from the month's goal, just to keep the thing going. And a $2 for every dollar contributed offer from horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner to help put us in the new studios. I'd think that there would be people out there just kind of cackling, wanting to break Dr. Rick. Or not Dr. Rick, but Rick. You know, we've got an offer of, you know, covering hotel space and everything, and we can get press passes, we can get booth space, and we can broadcast from first thing, you know, gavel to gavel coverage, literally, like you used to have, but like none of the networks provide anymore. We can have direct feeds off the podium. Everything that goes on there, we can provide you. I think it's the most exciting thing that I have ever considered this network doing. And if you think it's worthwhile, please drop me a note. We're talking about a process of trying to put together everything it takes to go and do it. And by everything it takes, I mean money, I mean computers, I mean renting the vehicle, everything that it takes to do it. And it's a logistical exercise that's like moving a small army or several small armies and locating them in one place. So I'd like to see via your email whether you think it's something that we should think about doing. Like I said, I'm sure some of the talk radio heroes will be there, some of the people you really like. But I don't think that anybody can put together a full-on network press like we can, because we're the only organization that has built ourselves for exactly such a situation. So tell me what you think, please. Because I'll make my decision largely based upon how you respond to the idea. Because if there's no interest in it for you, there's no purpose in it for us. I don't think the horn will ever have a better chance to gain increased visibility than this. But visibility be damned if it's not something that you want to hear. So please, you know, just, you know, let me know. You know the email address, bob@headonradio.com. Many of you may think that the Democratic convention will be a foregone conclusion then, and perhaps in terms of who the nominee will be, it will. I think the days of the smoke-filled room and the dickering and bargaining that goes back and forth to choose a nominee, those days are gone. What is not gone, however, is the discussion and the debate and the wrangling that goes on in order to determine what precise path the party will chart as they go into the election. And it will be interesting to see how that goes, see how that works out. I'll ask you a straight-up question. Would you rather watch Tweety Matthews talk about the Democratic National Convention, or would you rather hear Mark Levine, me, Guy James, Peter Godbold, Rick Goodner talk about it? I know what my answer is. So, you know, let me know, please. Let me know. And if there's enough interest, we will go forward and we will start trying to put together the means by which we make it happen. Fair enough? Now, you know the phone number if you want to jump in the conversation this evening. It's 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, then H-E-A-D-O-N, head on. If you've got your own long-distance unlimited calling plan, you can save us a nickel or a buck by dialing 304-658-5453. Like I said, email's bob@headonradio.com. A couple of emails have rolled in. On the one hand, we hear, wow, Edwards' announcement today sure took the wind out of my sails. I'm going to focus on keeping the Congress in veto-proof hands. Okay, since the Kennedys endorse Obama, let's ask Bobby Kennedy to notify them of the damage of mountaintop removal. I'm angry about what Edwards did because he let us down. I am so sick to death of politicians letting us down. I thought John Edwards knew that feeling. I thought he would ride the wave to the convention, or at least to Super Tuesday. There's no reason given for this, and no reason can be given for this. I'm sorry, but I feel betrayed again, and I get a real strong vibe of distrust from Obama. Ever see the Outer Limits episode where the handsome, charismatic presidential candidate is on board a plane and a ghost from the future tells him the plane is going to crash? Tells him if he jumps from the plane before it lands, they will save him? Pumps his ego so he'll do it? I guess you can guess the ending. He jumps, she fails to save him, and it turns out he's the worst dictator the nation would ever have had. But the current day he was running in, he was seen as a hero. I just get this vision of a snake when it comes to Obama, and it's not racial. It's a thing about his honesty. I just don't buy his show. Hillary? I think she's the only garbage man who could possibly handle the job, but it's anyone's guess if she would give us universal single-payer health care or some bastard monster she once wrote up to assuage the Republicans. Or would she give us another NAFTA? Or would she cut the ties with K Street and end fascism? I doubt it. Once again, the snake vision. McCain? He's completely insane and dangerous. I agree with Mike Malloy, Cindy says. The guy has a lot of sick stuff to work out from his days in Vietnam. So what to do, Bob? Keep pondering the snakes that are running, or work to put our focus on the Congress so we can have a veto-proof one and we can the next guy up in the White House without the ability to move? Well, I don't think it's a mutually exclusive. I don't think it's a mutually exclusive choice. I do know, however, that if you don't support the Democratic nominee, even if you have to hold your nose to do it, I know that you make it more likely that you get insane McCain. And I know that when you get insane McCain, you make it more likely that the number of dead from Iraq and Afghanistan will rise on his watch from 4,000 to 8,000, perhaps to 10,000 or 12. Or by the time the 100 years are gone, maybe by then, it's a 500,000 wasted American lives that we haven't even, whose parents aren't even born yet, whose grandparents aren't even born yet. I don't think that. I know that. So, you know, worth pondering. Again, it's about a fighting chance. Get yourself a filibuster-proof Senate, a profound majority in the House. Do so by telling the candidates running that you damned well expect to see Nancy Pelosi gone from the Speaker's chair. And put pressure on the Democratic candidates. Whichever one gets the nomination, make them understand that your vote costs them something. Not money, not a pint of Four Roses out of the trunk of an old rusting hulk of an automobile somewhere up a holler in West Virginia. Hell no! That there is real cost associated with getting your vote. The cost of conviction. The cost of determination. the cost of the real patriotism that it takes to save American servicemen and women from untimely, horrible deaths in a war that they didn't start, but that they must, by God, end. That is the cost. And it is entirely up to us if we will tell them that we are willing to see to it that they pay that cost. Or am I just some sort of... I had an email exchange with a listener, and I'm not gonna name the person, who told me today that because I wouldn't hustle Ron Paul, that they quote, "I'm done with you guys." I'm not a party apparatchik. I am not a my party right or wrong guy. Because you know what? I am mud to most of the big wigs in the Democratic Party in West Virginia, at least the ones who even know I exist. Because in West Virginia, it doesn't matter what county is behind your name, you know, D or R. What's behind your name, D or R, is the word coal. Coal is the real political party in this state. And I want nothing to do with it. And I will call BS every time I see a politician who is doing more to serve coal as his constituency or hers than to serve working people in this state. And I'll tell them to their face, and I don't give a damn what they think about it. If you're a coal whore, you're a coal whore, and calling yourself the Virgin Mary doesn't change it. And I feel that way about the Democratic Party on a national basis, too. I don't know why the House can't seem to find enough stomach, guts, nerve, spine to simply hold Josh Bolton and Harriet Myers in contempt. It's a simple vote. That's all it is. But they're so locked up in some sort of bizarre-ass calculus that, oh, if we do that, George Bush will be mean to us, and then November, and the election. Do these timid little fools not understand that we will reward them for being bold, that we will reward them for being brave, that we will reward them for honoring their constitutional oaths? Or is it just that there are so few of us that whether we do that or not doesn't matter because they're more concerned with the people who spend more time considering who they're going to vote for on American Idol? I honestly don't. I don't have the answers for that inquiry. But my God, you would think that holding a couple of contumacious contemners like Josh Bolton and Harriet Myers in congressional contempt, you would think that would be easy. All in favor? No. Okay, you're in contempt. But no, we seem to have a problem with that. Two nights ago, in his merciful final State of the Union address, George Bush threatened the Democratic Congress and told them how they would by God behave or how he would by God punish them. Poor little Nancy Pelosi got that pained look on her face like she had gas. So if you were listening to Guy James earlier today, you heard him playing the audio of Kenneth Copeland laughing at the United States Senate. Why would I listen to them? they got an 11% approval rating. And their mouth-breathing, strychnine-sucking, snake-handling audience of his sitting there laughing and roaring in the audience. That's not an extraordinary example. It is typical of the attitude that the right wing and the religion industry take toward Congress. How many people with guns are they going to send against me? I'll tell them to go piss up a rope. And you know what? It's going to continue until such time as the Democratic majority in Congress begins to act, by God, like the Democratic majority in Congress. Get a little spine. Get a little starch. Get a little toughness. No, I said we would expand our scope a little bit. By that I mean, Lordy, there's some new data out today from Reuters. Dateline London. More than 1 million Iraqis have died as a result of the conflict since the U.S. attack on that pathetic country, according to research conducted by one of Britain's leading polling groups. No, it's not the Lancet this time. It's not the Johns Hopkins study. It's not the Iraqi University study. No, no, no. This is opinion research business. A survey of 2,414 adults in face-to-face interviews in Iraq, and 20% of the people there had at least one death in their household as a direct and proximate result of George Bush's war, as opposed to natural causes. Now, you got to bear with the boring numbers part of the article. The last complete census in Iraq was conducted in 1997, and it found that Iraq had 4.05 million households. Using that number, Opinion Research Business calculated that approximately 1.03 million people had died as a result of the war. 1.03 million people. That's the better part of the state of West Virginia. Imagine that. That's Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Gone. That's, you know, Nashville. Gone. Birmingham. Gone. Madison, Wisconsin. Gone. You know, try to imagine, if you can get your mind around the concept of the number, try to imagine a million people and then imagine them not there anymore. In a state that, as we were constantly reminded when the Bush administration was making its excuses for why it couldn't find any weapons of mass destruction. Well, it's a state the size of California. Imagine a million people in a state the size of California, gone. Margin of error for the survey is plus or minus 1.7%. That means the range of the deaths for certain is between 946,000 and 1.12 million. You know, give or take a Haji. That's a tough one to get handed to you along about dinner time, isn't it? Opinion Research Business had originally found that 1.2 million people had died, but they decided to go back and conduct more research in rural areas so that they could make the survey as comprehensive as possible. And then they came up with the revised figure, and they revised it downward. They did the research in 15 of Iraq's 18 provinces. And here's one to make you not feel real good. Two of those provinces were in Iraq's more violent regions, Karbala and El Anbar. The northern province of Arbil wouldn't even let the surveyors in. So, in other words, because the survey was not done in the more violent regions, rather than trending downward, the numbers probably actually trend upward. So it is the blood of more than a million people in that oldest cradle of civilization that every day bathe George Bush from head to toe like the closing scenes of Carrie. Amazing, isn't it? Wonder how much coverage this is going to get. Wonder if Cutesy Couric will have any extended reportage on this figure. I'm sure somebody will ask Dear Leader in the Rose Garden about it or somewhere, you know, I don't know, in the pretzel room of the White House. I don't believe the study is credible. And yet he can say, 30,000 people have lost their lives. So he's okay with 30,000, but I don't believe that a million is credible. There is something sick and truly psychopathic about a mind that can discriminate between 30,000 acceptable civilian slaughters and a million of them and find 30,000 to be okay. Alan Hyde is the director of opinion research business. He said opinion research business had no objective other than simply to record as accurately as possible the number of deaths among the Iraqi population as a result of the invasion and the ensuing war that George started, and I would add, and the occupation following. Just the sterile business of engaging in a bit of a body count. And we did that. You and I, us, we, America, we the people, did that. And in the early going, a lot of Americans did it with a smile on their face. A lot of them are still driving around with little yellow magnetic ribbons on the back of their big gas-guzzling SUVs, the little yellow magnetic ribbons having been already manufactured in China in order to try to assuage some of the ungodly debt that we have incurred to do this slaughter. And they say, I support the troops. Well, I do too. I support the troops so much, I want them the hell home. I want mothers to stop worrying every time there's an unexpected knock on the door. I want fathers to quit going into a child's room and looking at a soccer trophy or a baseball glove and wondering in that, oh God, horrific way whether the winner of that trophy or the person who fielded with that little mitt
ever, ever, ever come home again, or if they will just be left to die in that rotten, filthy, stinking, blood-soaked, accursed sand. I want that over. And I know you do too. I know you do too. And if you do, then you know, like it or not, that come November, there's something you have to do. And it doesn't involve voting for John McCain or Willard the Rat Romney. This is America's Liberal Voice. I'm Bob Kincaid.
I remember your State of the Union address. Your call to duty, you called on our nation's best. You laid it out plain why our sons and daughters should fight. There was no question, it was all in black and white. And like so many, my son believed all of this. Without a shred of doubt, he marched off to enlist. Then came a memo from a place called Downing Street. How can this be true? What am I to believe? The flag-draped coffins that you don't want seen on TV. I had something that I'd like you to see. This is the pillow where he used to lay his head. Some old books I would read to him in bed. Here's a trophy from when he played Little League ball. Here's another day I spend staring at the wall. I keep a room of his things, but he's never coming back. Please tell me, why did my son die in Iraq? I need the truth from you, not from one of your paid hacks. Please tell me, why did my son die in Iraq?
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Everybody comes to Rick's.
If you can stand it, I can. Play it.
Howdy, Rangers. Tune into Rick's Place. You'll be fascinated with porn psychotherapist Rick Goodner's take on all of today's political issues from a real Texan's liberal point of view. So mosey on into Rick's Place for some good old hospitality with Rick Goodner. See you there, Rangers, this Saturday right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
And if you want another kind of love, I wear a mask for you. If you want a partner, open my hand. If you want to strike me down in anger, here I stand. If I'm your man.
Don't miss Rick's Place with Rick Goodner, part of the weekend lineup on The Horn, running all weekend in rotation with The Showers Report and Night Sounds.
I was dipping to the rain.
Howdy, this is Baxter Black, and if you're like me, you're concerned that the environment we enjoy today may not be around for our children and grandchildren. All the new technology in the world can't create more sky over our heads or new oceans. The Earth's natural resources, fresh water, land, and even the air we breathe are limited. Voluntary family planning improves the health of women and their children. It also helps slow population growth, which is good for our planet. So help ensure that people everywhere have access to the information and services they need to plan their families and help build a healthy future for us all. Population Action International is working to promote voluntary family planning around the world. Visit us at www.populationaction.org. That's populationaction.org. I'm glad to be back. I won't say welcome back because you didn't go anywhere. I did. Nah, I was just sitting here. I'm kidding. 12 minutes before the hour. And forgive me, please. But that notion of a million of anything, let alone people, let alone the blood's worth of a million human beings, weighs heavily upon my mind. And yet, in a way, I can't. The number's too damn big. And I think if you check the psychology on it, you would find that cognitive scholars and people who study the way the human brain works will tell you that we can calculate with these numbers, we can measure with these numbers, but we are fundamentally unable to get our head around the scope of these numbers. Whether it's a million lives or $1 billion or a trillion dollar war, we simply do not have, most of us,
the cerebral power to contemplate what that million means. I think that's why we come up with little euphemisms for it. I think that's why, instead of saying a million bytes, in computer terminology, we say a megabyte. I am right, that's a million bytes, right? So maybe we need a word to describe what we've done in Iraq. A megabush of Iraqis, civilians, who had nothing in the fight. No, nothing going on in the occupation. A megabush. Maybe that's the new word that we use to describe civilians needlessly slaughtered, dead civilians at the hands of the United States government and we the people. A megabush are gone in Iraq. How many do you suppose? How many gallons are the tears that are generated by a megabush? Is it a killer weep? We've had to. We simply have to come up with an entirely new and distinct linguistic measure for the evil that we have wrought in that ancient, parched, sad place, soaked in blood from the very first moment that human beings practically arrived there. But since 2003, introduced to a calculus of needless slaughter that region has seldom, if ever, seen. A kilochini of tears brought on by a megabush of slaughter. What do you think? Is it possible to linguistically represent the yawning chasm into hell that George Bush has opened in that land between the rivers? I don't know. I was going to move on, because that story, the cold sterility of the numbers somehow, in and of itself, has a stunning sort of, I just feel like I've been smacked in the forehead with the flat side of a ball-peen hammer. A million people? Jesus, I don't think my spirit could stand it if 10 people here in my neighborhood died. We lost our neighbor across the street a couple of days ago, and it felt like I'd been punched in the gut. But a million? Jesus Christ, a million? And you and me, we did it with our tax dollars. We did it with our complacency. We did it with our inability to get up off of our rotten, lazy asses and protest and demand of our elected leaders an end? Oh, I know. Our hearts are in the right places. We're against the war. A night doesn't go by that I don't make it clear that I'm against the war. But the war and the occupation still goes on. Do you think that any single member of that megabush, any single person who shed any part of that kilochini of tears, do you think any of those people
care whether they died of an occupation or of a war, or because Saddam was a bad man who gassed his own people, or because we were making the Middle East safe for democracy, or frisbees, or wheat checks, or whatever crappy little ginned up, dummied up, faked up, frauded up, rubed up little excuse the Bush administration comes up with next for why the blood is running as deep as our kneecaps in that place? Do they care? Or do they just know that their little baby girl is gone? Or do they just know that despite Saddam and upheavals in government and the drought and famine and everything that can beset a human being, that a 90-year-old woman survived it all only to be killed by the guardian of freedom? What are those people supposed to think of us? Do you think that the family of a dead Iraqi child killed at our hands gives a damn whether it's Republicans or Democrats in office over here? That's like asking what kind of grass they'd like to have grow on the grave. Do you think they'll draw a distinction in a grudge that will be carried for 1,500 years and passed down from generation unto generation? There's only one way to draw that distinction, and that is to make it clear that a certain group of people in this country will end this war and are determined to end this war. And that we will do so with our vote, that we will do so with our feet, and that we will put someone in office and damned well insist that the mega bush not continue to mount up into two mega bushes, and that there not be two kilochinis of tears. It is the only way. We have to get out. And then we look at the civilized world and we say, we're sorry, we broke it, we'll pay for it, but you guys gotta fix it. Because we cannot be at all involved in the restoration of that poor, broken land. Because we are not the solution, we have proven ourselves the problem. You try to tell that to John McCain, he'll tell you you're un-American. You try to tell that to Willard Romney, he'll ask you why you hate Jesus. Or Marani. Or whoever it is he worships. You have one chance. And one chance only. And it would appear that that chance now is going to be either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. I'm sorry, you don't get any other choices. I wish you did. I wish it was going to be decided at the convention, and that the final deciding factor was going to be the morality of ending the occupation now. But it isn't. And I'm not going to get up in the morning and find out that everything is sunshine and violets and the explosions have stopped all over West Virginia either. The typical American urge for instant gratification is not going to be satisfied anytime soon. It will only come the satisfaction of knowing that you have helped end the slaughter. Will only come with your hard work and your persistent, insistent demand that the people who say that they are better than the ones who started the war actually prove themselves to be so.
At least that would appear to be the situation. I don't know. If you're looking for answers, you're looking in the wrong place. This is a prayer meeting, not the Shell Answer Man. Right? Yeah. So we're going to see what's happening in labor news, and then we'll come back with the final hour of the program. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Dinosaurs went to hell.
Beer. That was pretty good. Okay.
Oh, you Catholics wearing condoms, you are going to hell. All us fatties eating bonbons, we are going to hell. Unbaptized babies learn. Limbo, purgatory is hell, and your religion is a gamble, and you are going to hell.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Five UAW Local 3520 bargaining committee members fired by Freightliner in April of 2007 after a one-day strike are getting some support now from the labor movement. The UAW International isn't supporting the workers' efforts to get their jobs back because the one-day strike was authorized only by the local and not by the international UAW. South Carolina AFL-CIO President Donna DeWitt supports these five UAW bargaining committee members fired by Freightliner, and she says they deserve some solidarity from the entire labor movement.
They weren't happy with the contract offer, and they were standing up for their rights. And I don't know exactly what happened with UAW, but all I know is there are five UAW members and officers of a local that have been out of work now going on 10 months. So I would appeal to everyone to reach out to help raise funds for these folks and their efforts to be rehired. You know, they need their jobs back.
The fired UAW Freightliner workers are visiting several cities, including Detroit, Chicago, and San Francisco, to tell their story and get support. To support these workers, you can go to www.justiceforfive.com to donate money to the Justice for Five Solidarity Fund. A deal reached between the Grammys and striking writers is music to the ears of the music industry, Jesse Russell reports.
With album sales declining year over year, the music industry can use any help it can get. One of the key promotional outlets for many artists is being tapped for a Grammy. Until Monday, that event was in jeopardy as writers continue a strike that is going on 3 months. The Writers Guild of America reached an interim agreement with the Recording Academy that will allow writers to work on the show. The Grammys are scheduled for February 10th. With the interim agreement reached on the Grammys, the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences are taking it as a sign that an agreement can be reached in time for their annual award show, the Oscars. The writers walked off the job in early November, and one of the primary sticking points is compensation for work that appears on emerging new media.
New Jersey is moving a step closer to passing family leave legislation. The controversial legislation passed the Senate committee on Monday by a vote of 8-6. If it succeeds, the act would provide 6 weeks of paid leave to care for a newborn or a seriously ill family member. A tax on workers' salaries would fund the leave pay of up to a maximum of $524 per week. Now here's Jesse Russell with today's economic report.
Foreclosures broke records in 2007, jumping by 75%. That equals nearly 405,000 homeowners losing their homes. In December of 2000, the foreclosure filings increased a whopping 97% over December of 2006. California was hit the worst in 2007, with 250,000 foreclosure filings. Michigan, already suffering from the job losses in the manufacturing sector, received a second punch in the gut, with 47,000 homes being lost.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Alrighty then, 6 minutes past the hour. I'd say about 50 minutes of conversation and cussing and discussing left in tonight's prayer meeting edition of Head On. Let's make the best of it. And let's work in a couple of, at least one quick prayer meeting sort of stories, just so that we can say that we did, in fact, do prayer meeting. How's about this one? How about, how about Matthew Joseph Elliott, 26 years old. He's a former aide to Willard Romney. You know, upstanding moral family values candidate, Willard Romney. Played a big leadership role in Iowa's college Republicans. He's an upstanding family values young Republican. The young fella, bless his little pointy, black little heart and pointy little head, just got picked up and busted. Arrested January 21st for outstanding warrants. Now, this is a Republican story, so you know how it ends. Outstanding warrants relating to his registered sex offender status. No, he wasn't caught offending. He'd already done that. He was trying to slide under the radar and pretend that he wasn't. He was convicted of exploiting a minor. Then, of course, there's also Glenn Murphy. He was arrested for sexually assaulting a sleeping man and performing oral sex on him. He was supported by right-wing Republican Congressman Patrick McHenry of North Carolina for the National Young Republican Chairmanship. Thanks to Pam Spaulding over at Pam's House Blend for that. Charming people, these family values, moral uprightness
or Pigwickens, who support the slaughter of a megabush of Iraqis and the shedding of a kilochini of tears. Just makes you want to stand up and sing the national anthem, doesn't it? Sure does. Let's go to the phones. Hey, have I got...
Got Kate here.
Hey, Kate, how are you?
Well, I don't know. I'm just kind of reeling from the show tonight. Thank you for having Jeff on that rocked. He's so cool. I've never heard him talk before.
Oh, I think that's his fourth time on the show.
Yeah.
He may have actually been on the show more than any other author. I think that's a for sure.
Oh, cool. Anyway, so many things have come to mind since the show started. What you're talking about, West Virginia being haunted, you know, in the future, and people wondering how the dead zones got there. But there are a lot of places in West Virginia that are already haunted. I've driven through there, and it's like there's some roads and highways that just suck the energy right out of me. Just the haints are everywhere. And some of the roads get me lost.
That's easy to have happen around here. I can get lost on the way to town.
One night I drove into a town, and I couldn't get out of it. It was just it might have been Beckley. Do you go down a hill into Beckley?
You go down a hill to everywhere in West Virginia.
Okay, well...
I'm not being a smart aleck. It's just...
It might have been Beckley. I don't know, but I couldn't get out, so I just found a motel and went drove around behind it and parked in it to bed, in my van, because it was just... and then, you know, it was just too spooky. It was okay in the morning, but that night it was pretty weird. And that was long before they started mountaintop removal, though I think it was back in the early 90s or late 80s. I can't remember. So it wasn't as bad. The big coal truck freaked me out, though.
You know, go ahead.
Hmm?
Go ahead.
Well, and one night I had, I don't know if it was in Southern Ohio or in West Virginia, I had there were ghosts on the sidewalk from the Civil War. They're just walking along and standing there staring at me. I was on a bus that time. That was too cool.
Well, speaking of the Civil War, one of the places that may be destroyed by this mountaintop removal job over on Gauley Mountain, that mountain extends down to a place called Gauley Bridge, and it was a Civil War redoubt. Bridge got burned, you know, that kind of thing. And there were emplacements on the mountaintop on the mountaintops surrounding Gauley Bridge.
Uh-huh.
And so that is, if the Civil War is our attempt to become a unified people and an attempt to cleanse our nation of several evils, then Civil War sites are hallowed ground, and that hallowed ground will be destroyed by, you know, the coal monsters.
Yeah, and the someone in the culture, in terms of the cosmos, somebody pays for that. It's to violate sacred hallowed ground is just, oh, my goodness. Anyway, speaking of sacred hallowed ground, and if my phone hangs up, I'll just call you back like Kevin did.
Okay.
I had a messy connection to Arizona today, but it might have been theirs. I read in the chat room early on when you were talking about Edwards, somebody wrote, oh, he really picked a good spot in New Orleans wearing a denim work shirt, standing in front of broken windows. Isn't that broken windows still in New Orleans? And I thought, oh, my God, I don't know where you live or where you've been, but broken window is nothing. I mean, oh, God.
Yeah, that's the upscale places with just broken windows.
Oh, shit. The window probably just got broken in one of the Mardi Gras parades. Oh, my God. I just wanted whoever, I don't know who wrote that, but I just want to let you know that the broken window was nothing. It's more hideous than you could ever imagine. Not as hideous as a million lives being gone in the Middle East, but anyway. And I also heard that Edwards was going to pull out the first thing this morning when I got up, and I thought, oh, my God, it didn't take long to sift out the main puppets to see who was going to entertain us while the culture's melting down. I just feel these people have floated to the top, and we didn't even have to make it to Super Tuesday. They're just weeding out the
That was Fred. Right? Kate, that was what surprised me a little bit. Because Super Tuesday is, what, a week away? Less?
Yeah. Less.
And why not stay in it for that?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. It just struck me that it just, well, goddamn, it didn't take long for that to happen, because now we've got this puppet show that we can just watch while everything is, you know, falling out around. And somebody said last night on the radio that Obama, you touched on it. I heard you talk about something. I was in the other room about something about his shady dealings in Chicago, or maybe it was Mark. And his million-dollar house, and his buddy that moved in next door bought a piece of property next door. Somehow that story is about to break, and
it's already broken.
Oh, it did. Okay.
The guy's a slumlord, and Obama has been tarred with that brush. However, if you go back a few years, you will find a picture of the same slumlord grinning like a fox eating poop out of a wire brush, standing between Bill and Hillary Clinton too.
Oh, cool. Okay, good. Oh, well, anyway. This is just, something feels real, really, really shady about all this going on, and it just, and I gotta say, was that email from Cindy in Washington?
Yeah.
I just, most of the time always agree with her. And about going to Denver to the convention, I've never even ever watched a recent, in the last couple of decades, convention, because I remember the ones where we had to sit on the edge of the seat clear up until 2 o'clock in the morning to see if the great state of Wyoming cast its vote, 3 delegate votes for, you know, John Kennedy. I mean, those were conventions, man. You didn't know nothing. Who was going to win? You didn't know who was going to be the nominee. Oh God, they were wonderful. And I don't know what happened. When did they quit doing that?
When it turned... let's see. I'm trying to think. 76? No. I guess the last really good one was 72.
Oh, okay. What did it change to? I mean, didn't we have Electoral College before that?
Sure we did. But the conventions are not as nominating processes. They were too uncertain, I think, for some
people.
Well, they were too uncertain for the people who were running the circus. They wanted an answer before they went in, so that it became a coronation rather than a fight. And there was, you know, among the political scientists and so forth, there was a determination not too long back, Kate, that smoke-filled rooms were bad things. I don't know if it was because of the smoke or they didn't like the room. No, the idea that the political wrangling of that sort was somehow disenfranchising. So then you get everybody ganging up and forming and creating Super Tuesday as an attempt to create a one-off sort of congratulations, you win, now it's over sort of thing. Because part of that is, of course, money. And it would be money whether we, to be honest, it would be money whether we had a clean election system or a corporate finance election system such as we have now. Because it's beneficial to the candidates, because if we know who the winner is early on, then you pull back and you don't have to spend all that money, and you can spend it beating the SOB in November.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it totally sucks in my mind, but then I'm sounding like a dinosaur. So.
It's certainly a more interesting process where you don't find out till 2 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that the media would like it better, because there would be something to cover. Conventions now are practically not covered at all.
No, we have circuses now, and they're just little, like, oh, well, never mind, we all know that. The people who took the campaign financing and the corporate structure and the lobbyists and the big business all took over. And I hear and I read all the ranting and the hand-wringing and you know, oh my God, and we got it. It's just a symptom of folks becoming aware of just how insidious the fascist structure has taken over our fledgling democracy.
I understand what you're saying, Kay, but let me back up for just a minute, please, if you don't mind. You talk about, you know, this candidate giving you the creeps or that candidate making you feel kind of slippery.
No, I said the whole time. No, not anybody particular.
No, I know. And that's what I'm trying to get to. I wouldn't leave my children alone in a room with any politician.
Oh, no.
Any more than I would leave my children alone in the room with a Roman Catholic priest or a fundamentalist preacher.
Mm-mm.
Or a Republican. But Democrat or Republican, I don't want my children looking up to politicians.
No.
And by the same token, politicians are going to make you feel a little bit icky because politics is icky.
Mm-hmm.
It just is because of the nature of the way that we have crafted it to be. Going all the way back to Thomas Jefferson getting slimed over Sally Hemings.
Uh-huh.
All right.
People should read Mark Twain.
Sure. You know, suppose I were an idiot, or suppose I was a member of Congress, but I repeat myself. You know, that's Mark Twain. And so the conclusion I'm kind of drawing from that, Kate, is that if we wanted angels in our political process, we would be nominating from convents.
Mm-hmm.
American politics is a down and dirty business, and it takes a certain kind of person to deal with it. They've got to have the hide of an alligator.
Yeah.
They've got to have the heart of a piranha, and the sensitivity of a scorpion.
But piranhas aren't heartless. They just do what piranhas do. They eat your ass if you get in their water.
Thank you for making my point for me.
Puppies pee on the floor. It ain't their fault.
Right.
Dang.
And politicians do what politicians do, and it's not their fault either. And that's why we try to put some rules in place, just like you put the paper down for the puppy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mm-hmm. I personally think we need more rules. Right now, we're at a point in our political system where we're not even putting a newspaper down, and we're letting puppy rot the subfloor.
Right.
We need laws. We need laws that say things like, if a politician is caught taking so much as one thin penny from an outside source, then they shall be consigned to 20 years hard labor at Fort Leavenworth. Yea, verily, end of sentence.
Not enough laws to put the people in jail for treason now.
No, we don't. No, we don't. No, we don't.
And
we've got laws that say we've actually got laws that say that you can't accept a meal from a lobbyist if you're sitting down.
Right.
But if you're standing up, it's okay.
Oh well, spitting on the sidewalk is illegal in some places too. So I just keep going back to this. We have been corrupted by the insidiousness of fascism, ruled by the corporate structure, and people are just now starting to realize that. And they, I think.
But when did that happen, Kate? Because for instance, we venerate Abraham Lincoln. Rail splitting Abe. Abe, who walked 12 miles to return a book that he'd borrowed and read by a candle so he could learn to read and saved and freed the slaves and round about. Abe Lincoln became a very, very wealthy man cheating people out of their land so the railroad could go through. That was how Abe Lincoln made his way in the world.
And I was raised in Montana, and where Jim Hill took up all the land and built the damn railroad track along the Canadian border, too. But yeah, I know. I'm not being clear here. I think maybe people are just now beginning to realize that. Let me back up then. That we have, and you alluded to it or hollered about it a few minutes ago, that we sat on our lazy dead asses and just let it go. And part of that is because of the education system. People don't know how laws are written. They don't have civics in school anymore. I mean, it's just gotten away from us, and I feel people just are getting scared because they know it's too late to take it back. too late to do anything about it. And they hear the echoes of Blackwater boots marching over the hill.
But if it's too late, why are we talking about it?
That's my question.
I'm not being contentious or contrary.
Neither am I. I ask that question every week I call in. Why are we talking about this stuff? It don't matter.
No. I don't mean why are we talking about the horse race. I mean,
no.
why not just go home, turn on American Idol, and quit?
Oh, I don't.
Whether it's the relief on the Gulf Coast or mountaintop removal or gender equity or sexuality equity or the takeover of America by the religion industry. Why don't we just quit worrying about it and sit back and be good little fascists?
It's easy to be a fascist.
It's very easy to live under fascism. Millions of Americans prove it every day.
That's right. You said you don't ask rhetorical questions. You just ask, why are we talking about it? Because I think we have an instinct to survive and keep on going on, but we get scared. But
at least on this side, Kate, what I'm getting at is that we have a very laudable and respectable sense of idealism.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as we are willing to work toward something we can call good, there's at least a remote chance, that same chance that I've been talking about all night long, there is at least a chance that we will see it come to fruition. And I will take chance over no chance any day of the week. That's my nature and the
And you were talking about getting we demand that this new president do this and that, and say, we demanded. Thousands of us marched before we went into Baghdad.
And went home.
Yeah. And then when Pelosi, thousands and thousands and thousands of us said, yes, this is going to change. You're going to do this. You're going to do this. And she didn't. And so now we just sit around and worry about old McCain's PTSD and how Senator Clinton looks in slacks and, we're not demanding shit. I'm sorry.
Well, but not me, not you, not us.
I'm talking about we as a culture.
I understand that. But by the same token, this is too big a mill to think that the wheels are going to grind with any speed at all. They will grind fine, but they will not grind fast.
Right.
So, we know for a fact that Nancy Pelosi was caught in public griping about it. You know, if they were just homeless people, I could call the cops and have them taken away for vagrancy.
But they're protesting
for the First Amendment, and they're protesting about impeachment, and they got First Amendment rights, and I have to put up with it. Oh, that pissed her off.
She hasn't even been back to her district to talk to her constituency, I think, since she took that office, and,
Well, no, she has been, because she was there to get pissed off at the very sight of people who were protesting to insist on impeachment.
Oh, was that her California home? I thought it was in D.C.
No, that was her California home. Yeah, my neighbors are very upset about this.
Oh. Wow. Okay. But I guess another spin on this, or what else goes around in circles in my head, is that while this is going on, what's happening with the million people getting killed in Baghdad and in Iraq, and there was a good story on All Things Considered last night by Ann Garrels about on NPR about the women in Baghdad and Basra who get pulled out of their cars and beaten and murdered for being too Western, like wearing lipstick or driving a car or working. And she talked to a woman who doesn't have a male cousin, so she's virtually held prisoner in her home to be a slave to the family because she can't go out on her own. And then further across the globe, tens of thousands of Chinese are starving and freezing at the train station trying to get home for Chinese New Year's. That's like their most sacred holiday of the year, and the government wasn't able, because they don't have snow down there in the south, the factories are shut down and the stock market can't make trades. And what was most interesting to me about what we're doing to the planet, though, what people keep saying, go
global warming. This is global warming. It's going to be 32 degrees here tonight. It's climate change, excuse me. There was some, I read someplace way down deep in the depths of some place I was wandering about on the web. There's scientific speculation that the Three Gorges Dam that they're building.
Yes.
The big amount of water that's up behind the dam has the surface of the water has disrupted the cooling and evaporation and atmospheric conditions of that part of China, and it's causing the snow and the freezing. And I thought, how cool is that? Real damn cool. People are dying by the hundreds. And, you know, there was a news note today that said they had 500,000 military go in to try to clean the roads and help the people out. And God, and there is, I think it said something, they're losing about $3 billion a week, the economy. So that can't be doing us any good, because if they're losing $3 billion a week, who are we going to borrow the damn money from to get those chump change pieces of crap checks that I'm not going to get because I'm on Social Security or whatever. Anyway, and did you... Is
well, you can't stimulate the economy.
That's right. I don't choose to. That's intentional. My diffidence is and my insurgency is intentional.
See, you'd probably do something crazy like, you know, feeding a poor person with it. We can't have that. Walmart has to have that money.
I buy a damn window to replace that one behind the Edwards Day. Oh, God, yeah.
See what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I'm a terrible person. Is it breaking news that there was a cable break between Egypt and Italy today, and that 70% of the Internet was down in the Middle East and all over that part of Europe?
I didn't. It might be. I didn't see it.
Oh, yeah. It's an underwater cable between Italy and Egypt, and I think it was like up in Turkey and all in through that whole in Mediterranean area that 70% of the Internet was down, including the Middle East, and then 50% of it went down in India.
Oh, God, I hope they don't have Verizon. It won't get fixed till sometime in the next century. Okay, I'm being a smartass again. I'm a bad person.
But I had to look at that too and say, well, that could have been an accident. You know, underwater cable could have ruptured or been cut by something, or it could have rotted or something. But it was awful suspect where the Internet went down all out, and like they can't even make the trades out of India or the stock trades out of India. And it's just a little suspect in terms of all that's going on with the collapse of the economy around the globe.
At this point, everything is suspect.
We just have to keep them from talking to each other. So let's go cut the damn cable. That'll work. Will that work? How's this working for you?
Jeremy, Casey, why don't you just unplug them? All right. That'll save the market. If we can't find out that their market's going in the toilet, then our market can't follow them. See, it's easy.
That's right.
Why do I got to do all the thinking around here?
Yeah, right. We don't have to. And we don't have to do that. Nor one that interest change, but decrease the interest rate. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah.
I don't even pay attention. I don't have any money, so this isn't a problem for me. But I just sit back and watch the circus and think, oh, I wonder what that word means. I'm joking. Just a few minutes ago, I mean, just like, well, I guess it was earlier today, I was on one of my web pages, and I was not aware of this, but there were 693 earthquakes in the contiguous United States last week.
What?
Yeah. There was, and I looked at the map, and there were three on the New Madras Fault, around Tennessee-Arkansas border, and then down in Arkansas, usual places, but it was unusual to have three of them in one week. I mean, they weren't huge ones. I mean, they weren't anything. They weren't like 7.1s. They didn't make the news. But the grouping of them was real interesting. There were six or seven on the Yellowstone Caldera, just right there, right in the little corner of Montana, Idaho, Wyoming.
As much as I'd love to see it, I don't plan on taking the family on a vacation to Yellowstone anytime soon. That sucker's going to blow sky high. But
well,
that's just
that's
me.
Weird.
we're gonna be toast when it does. But the ground temperature in some of the places in Yellowstone are too hot to walk on. They've been fenced off. You can't even get into them because the ground is up over 200 degrees and it burns your shoes and whatever. And there was a big one right in central Colorado and right in the middle of Texas, which was an unusual place to have one. And there was one up in northeast Ohio and one down in southeast West Virginia. They weren't very big ones, but they were. It's just the grouping of them and the frequency of them all in one week just kind of. And hundreds on the California fault, of course, and there were more than 20 up in the volcano regions up in Washington and Oregon, where Mount St. Helens is, and all those beautiful Five Sisters volcanoes. And I just look at that and I think, oh, God, Mother Earth is so annoyed. Ooh. And we're worried about the stuff of circus, which is huge stuff. Supreme Court is probably the biggest thing on my radar screen, but we're worried about all this stuff when all the world is going on around us, and we're not even paying any attention to it.
Well, we can't. We are a nation suffering from attention deficit disorder that no amount of Risperdal or Adderall or Ritalin can cure us of because it's self-inflicted.
Mm.
It's why we're here, Kate. You know, it's an attempt to talk about things and share information. I don't believe that when I open the mic every evening that I've seen everything. I do a bunch of reading. I try to see as much as I can, but I can't ever see it all. So I depend on people like you and others to bring this information up. We discuss it. We try to make a little bit of head sense out of it, horse sense out of it, and wait to see how it connects to the information that somebody else has.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, we can maybe have a healing, returning to our prayer meeting theme, we can have a healing of our ADD.
Yeah.
Because, you can get your ADD healed, you just can't get a limb growed back.
This is like Ernie Pyle's Postcards from the Road, you know. I mean, it's just like travel around the country on the conversation radio and hear what's going on and what other cultures and what other people are doing. And that brings me around to the conversation that we had last night and on the air and in the chat room and in emails that was absolutely wonderful, because it's just like the institutional racism and bigotry are just floating to the top. And that's not a bad thing. It's
I gotta tell you something, Kate. I saw the ad that Carolyn Kennedy voiced for Obama, and I'm gonna say this and I'm gonna hate myself for it, okay? I wish she hadn't. I just really, really wish she hadn't, because it opens with color footage of John Kennedy and something along the lines of, once upon a time there was a man who felt like it was worth the effort to try to bring us all together. And these John Kennedy references, and then a slow edit into Barack Obama, and now we have another man like that. And from my vantage point, being a fan of history and an occasional observer of the fact that if God is anything, he is a God of irony, I saw that thing and I got cold chills on the back of my neck. One, because it's a very moving ad, but two, because I don't want it to come true, for his sake.
Me too.
Because you know what, the other side kills the John Kennedys of the world and the Martin Luther Kings and the Bobby Kennedys and the Malcolm X's and the Gandhis.
I said that weeks and weeks and weeks ago. If he makes it through the primary process, and even probably wouldn't even make it to the White House, his ass is going to get capped before he can even stand around. I mean, it's just...
I mean, the Secret Service have proven themselves fairly effective and in keeping...
Well, they let it happen.
Well, this is not the time for the JFK assassination debate. But, you know, let's see. Squeaky Fromm managed to squeeze off a couple of rounds at Gerald Ford.
Right.
And
That's what I said.
James Brady took a bullet for Ronald Reagan, and more's the pity there.
I
know the America we live in, and I'm scared. I am scared to death. I'm scared for Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm scared for Hillary Clinton, too, because, again, the right wing has kept America on a boiling point of Hillary hatred for, 16 years now.
Yeah.
And don't think that one of those right wing crazies wouldn't cap either one of them if they got a chance, and especially if they were actually beginning to make inroads toward bringing this country back together again.
Right.
Please remember that for any ill I may have spoken of him being a man who made his nut on ripping people off and stealing their land from them, Abraham Lincoln actually did have plans in place to not punish the South and try to reunify the country on a peaceful, brotherly basis. He had that plan until John Wilkes Booth, as part of a proven conspiracy, popped a cap in him.
Right. Secret Service did it again. Whatever. Well, I guess these issues that the contentious, the Hillary stuff, I mean, the black, white, the gay, straight, the Christian Islam, male, female, and all kinds of xenophobia that we have about the Mexicans and the Indians and the Chinese and all them Arabs. And I mean, we just have to keep talking. We just have to keep talking. We've already gotten to be the largest third world country on the planet, and the elites are just pitting us against each other, and we're just going to wind up in tribal warfare. I mean, that's already happening around the country. You can't go in this neighborhood or that neighborhood, or these people are hurting these people and killing these people. I mean, it's already happening in this country.
Oh, speaking of which, you mentioned them Arabs. There's a little low rent hissy going on in Mississippi right now. I've got a story here. I love the way they monkey with the language. A Mississippi-based immigration activist is appalled that potential terrorists were among a group of illegal aliens apprehended by federal agents in a sting operation along I-20 in the Magnolia State. What it boils down to is a truckload of undocumented aliens was busted on I-20 in Mississippi, and among the group was an Egyptian and a Palestinian.
Oh, dear.
And out of that, this organization, Mississippi-based immigration activist, okay? Usually immigration activists...
Planned?
No. Usually an immigration activist is somebody who is interested in seeing some degree of justice or decent treatment for...
No, down there they wear shoes.
Immigrants. But this guy, this guy is a character by the name of Rodney Hunt, and he's a member of a group called Mississippi Federation for Immigration Reform and Enforcement.
A.K.A. KKK.
Yeah, well, you know, this Meyer, Mississippi Immigration Reform and Enforcement, Meyer. And he says, I think this just shows that these people from these special interest countries are not just people coming here taking jobs from Americans, but we have potential terrorists.
Yeah, right.
Now, there's no evidence to suggest that these guys had any terrorist tie.
Mm-mm.
There's no evidence to suggest that this Palestinian and this Egyptian were anything more than people trying to work in America.
And they probably came from Tuscaloosa, where they're building the freaking condominiums on the campus with the money that's supposed to go to the Gulf Coast down in Mississippi. Come on. Damn.
Right, but you know, they're potential. I think they're potential terrorists.
Yeah, well, maybe. Jesus. The people all over the including Caucasian people have said, if it weren't for the Mexicans, this place would never, ever, ever be as rebuilt as far as it is has gotten.
Sure.
And so, you know, I did. Oh God, what a pig that guy is! Potential terror. Oh my God.
And it comes off a news site of a Christian organization.
Of course it did. Of course it did. And they could have been that van load of people could have been part of a crew, a mission crew that was working on houses on the way down to the coast, working with the. With the Amish or the Methodists from Ohio.
And that probably goes to show that they were potential tourists because they were down there trying to keep us from being able to repopulate the region the way God wants it to be, or else he wouldn't have sent that hurricane.
Get all them black folks back in their homes.
No, get them out of there.
Right. they're terrorists. They're
send them to Salt Lake. Yeah. Send them to Salt Lake City where we outnumber them real good and their vote can't matter.
Yeah, well, see, that's what I'm saying. The elite, they're just pitting each other. They're pitting us against each other. And the only way that I've found that ever to get to know a culture is to learn the language and eat the food and sing the songs and visit their country or their villages or towns or whatever, and that includes here in this country, too.
Yeah.
When I live with people who I'm not familiar with that kind of scare me because I of my own ignorance and naivete, once I get to know them, if I have been given entree into their culture by one of them, you know, a friend or an acquaintance or something, you know, go to dinner and then kind of learn, you know, befriend some people from that culture. It just scares me. When I listen, I'm watching really carefully what's happening in Kenya, and the same thing's going to happen here. We're just we're back to the prayer meeting. I mean,
I've got a story here, Kate, headlined U.S. Envoy, Kenya Violence is Ethnic Cleansing.
Oh, yeah.
U.S. Envoy Jendai Fraser said Wednesday the violence in Kenya's Rift Valley was clear ethnic cleansing, yada, yada, yada. I'm wondering if he's ever looked at the Gulf Coast or New Orleans.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, here's our envoy to Kenya worrying about Kenyan ethnic cleansing. But, you know, a little closer to home, we've got an ethnic cleansing problem of our own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, I'm a smart aleck, and I see U.S. Envoy Jendai Fraser. And the first thing that comes to my mind is Howard Cosell. Down goes Fraser. Down goes Fraser. I'm pitiful. You know that, Kate? I'm just pitiful, the way my mind works.
Yeah. You know, you shared that story about the judge last night, and I thought, oh, my God, that sounds like, that reminded me of my mother, and this is pitting us against each other, and because of our ignorance, we're racist, and we don't understand the culture, and we don't, she was just a rabid racist, first with African Americans in Indianapolis all of her life, and then she moved to a little town in Idaho where my sister was, and that's where she got kind of this thing going with the Mexicans. Actually, they were whatever. And so she's going on and on one day, and I said, Ma, do you know any Mexican grandmas your age? And she said, well, no. And I said, do you realize that those grannies have the same situation that you do, like very little money, and they have aches and pains, and they got rowdy good-for-nothing grandkids that don't ever visit them, and they're lonely and isolated just like you are here in this dusty little potato town, and they don't want to be here just like you. And that never, she said, well, no. And I, all those years, I just always wished I knew a grandma there in that little town in Idaho where I could introduce her so she'd know that there was other grandmas who had the same kind of life that she did. But she was scared of them. Because the kids dressed funny and they played funny music, you know, and they talked too loud on the street. And she was just scared of them because she couldn't understand the language. And they were, you know, as I thought, if you just knew the grandma, Ma, you'd know that those kids are the same little rabbit, those same little kids that you've got for grandkids, too. You've all got the same grandkids. And I always just was so sorry that I didn't know a Mexican grandma in Rigby, Idaho, that introduced mother to at the senior center or something. Well, the Mexican grandma would have been clean in the senior center because my mother was Caucasian, but We just can't any longer presume this Caucasian dominance that we have, because we're not the majority anymore, and we just can't go around pretending that we, that they are invading our country and they're taking over. Oh. We can't do that anymore.
What do we do? What are we going to do?
I know. Kate, thanks so much, dear.
Yeah, it's been good talking to you.
I've burned up a bunch of your minutes.
Oh, hell, I forgot this isn't after 9 o'clock. Oh, well.
Yep.
Take care. Good talking to you.
All right. Bye. And very quickly, oh, wait a minute. Let me do this right. Nope. Hi, who have I got?
Hi, this is Bob.
This is Bob.
Hey, Bob, this is Eric from Vermont. How you doing?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm hanging in there. I get slow coming on here. I don't get out of work until 7 o'clock. Maybe you can catch me up on the reason why Mr. Edwards dropped out of the race, because I haven't had time to do some things.
Sadly, no, I can't. That's the $64 question today, is why he got out when he got out. It frankly makes no sense to me, simply because Super Tuesday is so quick. I mean, it's Honest Tuesday. But today was the day that he decided to bail out.
What are you unofficial? Because he promised everybody he was going to stay in there for whatever. I mean, he and his beautiful wife, who has gone through an awful experience in her life in terms of the cancer that was cured, then remission, and so on and so forth. I mean, he has said that was like a decision they made, and I felt like, I mean, he was talking something real in terms of his commitment between he and his wife, you know, for whatever is going on behind closed doors, or...
Well, anything that we say is speculation. So...
Absolutely.
There's no hard answer. We can sit here and guess. Now, a couple of things that are factual that can be pointed out. He did not technically withdraw from the race today. Technically, he suspended his campaign.
Okay.
Now, what that means is that for so long as he continues with the campaign suspended as opposed to ended, then he can continue to draw federal matching funds so he can continue to pay his staffers. That's the way that that was explained by the so-called professional media. I don't know if that has any deeper or greater meaning.
Well, I watched something on Democratic Underground that was linked to TMP link with about 11 minutes of oratory in New Orleans by John Edwards, and he didn't seem like he gave a good reason. I mean, he seems like he said he had consulted with Obama and Hillary and concerned himself with poverty, and he was assured by Obama and Hillary that poverty would definitely be a prime first issue kind of thing, and he also indicated that we will never forget you and the American people for supporting and so on and so forth. And there was a lot of stuff that he wasn't saying.
Which, of course, only feeds the speculation, and you can't help but wonder if what he was signaling is that some sort of a deal has been made somewhere along the way. Whether it's a deal for a position for him in the cabinet or a deal for specific platform planks at the convention, we don't know. But by saying, well, you know, it's time to step aside less than a week before Super Tuesday...
Would you agree that would be called open democracy in terms of the American people having information that would be sufficient to be able to support any one candidate, whether it be Hillary, whether it be Obama?
I believe in putting information forward.
Dodd or anybody else that happens to be among the first eight or nine Democratic people that the MSM did not cover?
I would tend to support that that assessment. The other thing that puts itself forward is the fact that while one might speculate that some sort of a deal had been struck, it's hard to say that there's any truth to it, simply because the other thing he did not do is give any kind of an endorsement. So he didn't endorse one candidate or the other. He suspended his campaign instead of ending it, and he said he was stepping aside. So it's the kind of thing that's uncomfortable and unpleasant, because it leaves us in a position of having to sit here and wonder and guess. And I think we deserve better than guessing.
I think you're 100% correct. I think we deserve more than guessing. I mean, I gave a substantial amount of money that I can't really afford to supporting his commitment with his wife's condition, which he made a very, very large issue, and we are together on this, me and Elizabeth, for going all the way to the open summer nomination process and so on and so forth. And I'm extremely disappointed with the message that I heard, and I hope that he has something that he can add on to that in terms of the TPM link that was started on DU for 11 minutes that I watched, because I didn't see anything there that I was really impressed with. And I feel extremely let down. Anyway.
Well, I think a lot of people do. That's been the nature of what I've seen in the chat room. I've seen it in the email. And I've read about it all day long. A lot of people disappointed, because there were a lot of people who felt like he was giving them an alternative to what appeared to be a pair of prepackaged, pre-selected candidates,
which we had by the MSM, which said, okay, you got Hillary, Obama, and that's been going on for a year. Then the Republican side has been, and we knew pretty much it was going to be John McCain on the other side, but on the left side, we knew pretty much the MSM was going for Hillary and Obama, because they've been giving nothing for anybody. I mean, Kucinich has great ideas. But that's not a matter of the political process in this country. We listen to ideas, and then we let the American public decide what the ideas are. We don't let the MSM, mainstream media, tell us which candidates we're supposed to listen to and then make our decision, because that's what they want us to listen to.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But it's been turned into a beauty pageant. That's why I quit calling these things that are being passed off to the American people as debates. I quit calling them debates. I call them pageants. Because there's nothing of substance discussed. There are no real issues put forward. And you wind up with battling and bickering and snarking and sniding. And it's not anything that does any credit or service to the American electorate.
So the American people never really get the information that they really need to know about how to select the next person that is going to be dealing with so many important, absolutely crazy issues in terms of our country, our economy, our school systems, our poverty, our world situation in terms of the diplomacy, the wartime issues, the Department of Defense issues, where we have so many political people involved with Department of Defense at this point.
Oh, yeah. And, Mark Levine put forward an absolute master class on how to select a candidate this evening on his program. He spent.
I apologize.
Oh, don't apologize.
I'm getting out of work at 7 o'clock.
Yeah, no. Well, it'll roll on the rerun stream, and if you want to check it out, it's on the archive too. But he put out 45 solid minutes of information, going back and forth as to who stood for what and which and why and how, and explained how he came to his decision. If every American went through that process, I think I said in the chat room at the time, we never would have had a Reagan or a Bush in the White House. But I've got to roll right now because we are flat out of time. I'm glad you called, and I hope you will again.
Well, I try when I can.
All right. Well, anytime.
Keep up the good work, and it's always good to have dissension.
It is. The dissension leads to consensus. Take care. Bye now. Sorry, everybody. Got a bunch of lines lit up, but the fact of the matter is we're out of time. So thanks, everybody. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Be part of the solution. Join Coal River Mountain Watch. Help us fight the fight. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
Kids, it's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the Dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 110 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively on the listener-supported Head-On Radio Network, also brought to you by Coal River Mountain Watch. That's crmw.net, Coal River Mountain Watch. You can help keep the packets passing and the streamers streaming by stopping by headonradionetwork.com and clicking on the PayPal button. Yes, my regular listeners have already identified that my voice is pretty strange this evening. And what you've been hearing, the rumors of my vocal problems have all been true. If you recall, last Friday evening was the last time you and I were together, and my voice was a little odd then. Then by the time Sunday and Monday rolled around, I couldn't speak a word, so I'm slowly regaining it. Occasionally, it goes from high to low like a teenager, but we'll get by. And we do have a guest scheduled for this evening. Bob's probably trying to get the guest on the phone now. And if the voice goes, we'll just turn the whole show over to Justin Utley. Thank you. Thank you indeed for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Wednesday, January the 30th, 2008. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m. on a Wednesday, that is January the 30th, you are indeed listening to a live show, and you're welcome to call in and participate and speak to myself and to the guest. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests, as well as the audio archives from past shows, and links to the guest site. By the way, our guest this evening is Justin Utley, and he has an amazing story. He comes from Salt Lake City, and he was a gay Mormon kid growing up in Salt Lake, and made it all the way to the Big Apple, and is a widely recognized musician. And we're looking forward to having Justin on the show. As I was saying, the show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com. You'll find links to the guests and the audio archives from past shows, and you'll find links also to Justin's websites, as well as some additional photographs from Justin. You'll find links there to the chat room and also to Head On Radio Network's main site, where you can find out about the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network. There are links there, too, for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the show. Bob has our guest on the line now. The guest is on hold listening in. Justin, you probably missed this, I said at the beginning of the show, but I'm recovering from a case of laryngitis, so I was just joking with the listeners that if, in fact, my voice goes out, I'm just going to turn the whole show over to you, and we'll have you on the air. Justin Utley was born in Salt Lake City, Utah, and he began performing piano at about